Of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Kebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Street Books, Revelry in the Park Book Celebration, and 12th Summer Season Kickoff on Monday, June 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the South Park Blocks in Portland. Street Books is celebrating their 12th summer season of providing bicycle-based library books and community to those living outside in the Portland area. Street Books is accepting donations of reading glasses, coloring books, graphic novels, and art supplies. Again, that's Street Books Revelry in the Park Book Celebration and 12th Summer Season Kickoff on Monday, June 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the South Park Blocks between Southwest Jefferson and Southwest Madison in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Times Like Now is an interview program. Interviews with interesting people and the stories that they tell. On this episode, it's been 42 years to the month since Mount St. Helens blew a third of its top off. My guest, Rob Robertson, drove through the dark ash-covered roads that day, and he shares his story with me. I'm Trevor Collins, and this is Times Like Now. Rob Robertson, thank you so much for joining me on the program today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So you have a very unique story, I think. The simple fact that, you know, the world was watching our little corner of the Pacific Northwest on that day. The whole country and the whole world was watching Mount St. Helens do its thing. And not a lot of people got to see it from the perspective that we here in the area did. Take me back there. Set the scene. Take me back to that morning.
That morning, I was actually in Washougal, Washington. I worked in Spokane, but my future wife, fiance at the time in 1980, was living in Washougal. So I was down visiting her. And so that's where I was when my journey started.
What was the morning like when you woke up and heard the news?
Woke up to my mother-in-law waking us up, and future mother-in-law, and she said, "Hey, you guys, Mount St. Helens blew." And so we just got up, looked outside, and saw the craziness, and then turned on the news and saw the craziness. And this was Sunday morning, so I had to get back to work to Spokane. So that's when I basically said goodbye to them and decided to drive to Spokane, probably against the better judgment and better wishes of my future wife.
So driving right into the ash and the potential of,
yeah,
who knows what's going to be up the road. And now tell me about the vehicle you were driving.
I was driving a 1972 Volvo which was in great condition. And so I was well prepared as far as driving a pretty good vehicle to get up there. But my journey started with me driving across the interstate bridge into Portland and deciding to drive down Highway 80 towards Idaho on the Oregon side. The cool thing about that was that I could look off to my left and follow the mountain and follow the ash going due east. So I was just trying to race the ash and try to get ahead of it. And so that was pretty epic view from looking to the left of me and watching the ash cloud go and me speeding down Highway 80 to try to beat it.
And what time did you leave? I mean, how long did it take for that ash to really start? I mean, did the sky go dark on your journey?
Not where I was, because I was going parallel to the ash cloud. But
right.
This is about 9:30 in the morning. So the mountain, I think, blew right around 8 o'clock in the morning, or roughly 7 something.
8:30, I think.
Yeah. And so I'm driving down the freeway parallel to the ash cloud, and I get to Tri-Cities, Washington. And that is where you go from Oregon to Washington, over a couple bridges over the Columbia River. And then you get into Tri-Cities, and then Tri-Cities was right on the edge of the ash cloud. So if you could imagine any epic movie where you're in clear skies and then you see just nothing but black and dark and thunder and lightning going off ahead of you. And so that's when I started getting towards the mountain, or getting towards the giant cloud of ash. And Tri-Cities is still about another 4 hours from Spokane, and I'd been on the road for about an hour and a half at this point. And so it's about 10:30 in the morning at this point, and I decided to get some supplies because it was important if I was going to go into this cloud of ash. And this is where it gets a little funny, is I stopped at a gas station, and I didn't have a map. And this is 1980, so this is before cell phones and all that. So I pulled into a gas station, and pretty much everything was well deserted. So there was a lot of cars on the road. I pulled into the gas station, filled up the tank full of gas, went inside, and I needed a supply. So I bought a 12-pack of beer. And a box of Ritz crackers for emergency supplies.
So, well stocked.
Yeah. It was, you know, here I am. How old was I? 21, 1 year old. So I was a little concerned about my livelihood, and I didn't want to spend much time at the gas station. And again, I didn't have a map to drive because I knew I was going to probably end up driving some back roads. So I stared at the wall. There was a giant map there. And I was looking at the map, and I saw all the roads, back roads to Spokane. And I ended up memorizing the rights and the left and the left turns and the numbers and then the street names and the highway names. So anyway, got back into the vehicle and started driving. And within a half a mile, I was stopped by a roadblock, and it was the fire department. And they said, the road is closed. You can't go any further. So instead of turning around, I just basically told them that I need to get through there because I have to go to work. And they said, well, you we're not allowing anybody to go by there. I said, well, I know people just down the road. And he said, all right. So he let me go by there.
Fibber.
Yeah. And then I made it about another 5 miles, and then State Patrol was there. And again, they said, no, you're not going through. And the State Patrol, they had already put these exterior exhaust things on their exhaust pipes or something from coming from their engine. So the exhaust pipe went up so they could, their ash wouldn't get into their engines. And I thought that was kind of odd, but that was kind of cool looking. And the ash was already starting to get onto the roadway, so the ash was around probably 8 inches deep already.
8 inches deep? in two and a half hours?
Yeah, and it was like a just a cloudy, ugly, powdery snowstorm. And so when I got to this roadblock, same thing, said we're not letting you go through, and I said, I just know people right down the road, which was the truth. It just happened to be a 4-hour drive. he said, all right, go ahead and go. And so, but every time I had to roll my window down, the ash got into the gears of my window. And
Was it electric windows?
Yes. And but the ash is crystal, and it's kind of glassy, so it's real rough material. So when it got in there, and I kept rolling the window down to talk to a policeman, it finally ground the gears, and I couldn't roll the window back up. So I was about 4 inches from the top, and several times I had to stop. Now it is pitch dark out, and so the only thing I could see is from my headlights is this snow falling, or this giant ash falling, and that's all I could see. So several times I had to get outside my car to scrape off the headlights, which were now 4 inches deep in ash. And I couldn't breathe either, because you can't cover your mouth, you don't have a gas mask or anything like that. So I found in my suitcase a sock. So I tied a sock around my face, and I had a baseball cap on and my glasses, and I just went out there, covered my mouth up with the sock, and scooped out the headlights. And you're driving, and I got back in, but the ash is now coming through my window, and now I've got about 6 inches of ash in my back seat, and it's flowing around because the window's open.
Wow.
And so and if you get off the ruts in the road too, the ash just buries you like you're just diving into the ocean. It just comes right up over your car, and it's light, it's fluffy, and you just got to stop the brakes for a second so you can get back into the ruts of the ash. And if there's no vehicles that have driven this before, which there hasn't been, you're just putting this ash right over your front of your car, and you it's crazy. So
what kind of distance were the headlights reaching? Like, what are you visibility wise?
Maybe 10 yards. And so I was driving probably 10 to 15 miles per hour.
Right. That was my next question.
Yeah. And it was crazy because you could hardly tell a road different than the side of the road or a open field or something. So you're hoping you're still on the road. street lights, couldn't hardly see them, just way in the distance, maybe. Sometimes you get a little clearing, and then would just go away real quick. And I'm still driving. Probably the biggest part of the ash cloud was about the same latitude as Spokane and as the mountains. So I'm still driving diagonally into this ash cloud. And keep in mind too, I left about 9:30 in the morning, and it is probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon now, and it's still pitch black. And when I was at the gas station memorizing streets and stuff, I was still hardly, you can't see the street signs now, and I'm just guessing, taking a left here, taking a right here. I stayed off the major highways only because I couldn't find them at this point. So I was just driving as diagonal as I could.
Driving blind. Yeah. Driving blind.
And just hopefully you're staying on a road. But I knew I'd be saving even if I had to spend the night, because I had a 12-pack of beer and Ritz crackers. Eventually, I got there. See, this was Sunday morning, 9:30. I got there at 1:30 in the morning Monday to Spokane, which is normally a 5-hour drive, worst case.
Right. Now, in those next number of hours, I mean, did you run across other people that were out in it? And did you see others struggling and having issues? What's kind of the, what was the road story about? Any hitchhikers?
No, fortunately for them. It was eerily quiet, eerily alone. I mean, quite literally, the only cars I saw were the state patrols that were occasionally out there, and the fire department, which stopped me at the roadblock. Even driving past people's homes and stuff, lights were off. It was just really creepy. It was like last man standing on the planet Earth when there was, you know, the mountain blew. And it was like, man, this is weird. And the radio, I had a fairly consistent, but this is, again, 1980. You didn't really have a great radio reception anyway, and I had AM radio. So I was trying to catch any radio stations that I could hear, and most of it was just saying the condition of the mountain, and they're still looking for survivors. Please stay off the roads. Do not breathe it. Do not wash it down with water, because their first anticipation was that it's going to be sulfuric acid, that the water and the ash mix together, and it's going to corrode things and be potentially dangerous to breathe or touch. So here I am, covered with ash, head to toe, because my window's down, and having to go out and scrape my headlights off about every 5 miles. So it was very interesting journey, one I didn't anticipate. And it was only just so I can get back to work. I should have just stayed with my future bride.
Yeah, I was saying, I'm sorry, I can't make it. I'm going to take some time off.
Exactly.
Did you cross rivers? Did you see like anything coming down rivers? I know there was a lot of tree loss that put those trees into the water system.
No.
Did you run across that?
No, I didn't, because that was north of me. That was up near Tootle River and Lewis County, which is the next county north of us. And I was going to the other side of the state in a path. So I didn't see any of that. It was just, again, I was driving through pitch darkness. When I got there, I had to knock on the door because my roommate had the door locked and I didn't have the key to the place. And my roommate opened the doors, and all he was staring at was a guy covered in ash with eye holes under his hat, and also
and a sock in your mouth,
a sock tied around my head. And he's like, "What the heck? Why? Where had you been?" So anyway, after explaining that, we got.
And that was it. And that was at 1 a.m.
Yeah, that was 1 to 1:30 in the morning after a long, long drive. And first thing we did is got up in the morning and listened to the news. And there was a state of emergency. There was no television. The only thing you could hear was the, you know, that test they do with the National Broadcasting System.
Right.
That was what was in control of our television. So there was no news to watch. There was the radio was the only thing that was broadcasting news. But then again, you were only listening to the state of emergency. So you were supposed to stay off the road, we were told. We were supposed not to use water to spray off your cars or your houses or your animals or whatever. There was these large fields of crops where cows and gardens and farms that were now 1 to 2 feet deep in ash. And
I mean, so you had to wash this ash off of your face and your hair and your, and they told you not to use water? I mean, what?
Yeah, because their initial impressions were that it was going to be caustic and burn you or worse. And so my roommate and I immediately got up on the roof of our house because you could see a long distance. But everything was blanketed in this kind of white, grayish ash. But we repeatedly grabbed the hose and started hosing off the house. And every neighbor in the neighborhood started doing the same thing. But we were shut down for a week. The whole a week to 10 days without any television or anything in the state of emergency. You were not supposed to go over 15 miles an hour. And literally, if a car drove by any faster than that, it was the ash was whipped up and it'd take 10 minutes to get back down to normal. So there was that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a small medicine bottle, like a, you know, turn of the century medicine bottle with ash
in it that I still own that I gathered up during that time. And yeah, just looking at the consistency and kind of, I put some in my hand because it's, I mean, I haven't opened this jar in 20 years, but the anniversary had me thinking about it and your story. I wanted to feel it on my skin. It's interesting stuff. It is so light and powdery.
Yeah.
It's less than sand.
And people don't know it, but there's still a lot of it out there. If you're in between Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, there's a town called Longview and Toledo, Washington. And that whole stretch of highway there is when that Toodle River and everything got flooded, and it was flooded with ash and just one giant, looks like concrete flowing down a river, and all the logs and everything. They excavated all that out of there and put it next to the highway and just started piling it up. And so these piles are still there, but people just think that it's a big mound of dirt because now there's grass growing on it and it's camouflaged, so you don't know it's there. I'm in the construction industry, and they're putting new gas stations in along the highway all the way up to Seattle. And these gas stations are digging into this ash, and they're having trouble finding the base of it. So they're having to dig even further down by another 10, 15 feet just to find solid dirt so they can actually put the foundations of these gas stations in and stuff. It's pretty crazy.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember going I was a younger kid at the time, but traveling with my parents through that, some of that deep, and seeing it alongside the roads piled up like small pyramids or you know, just pure ash for miles. And I always was concerned, being, you know, living in the Portland area as a kid, if that mountain were to have blown south instead of north into the much less populated area, if that had hit, the different story if it had come down the Columbia River.
Yeah, it would have been pretty devastating. It actually had a little bit of that when the wind was going differently. I think it was a month prior to that. It did what I would just call a tectonic burp, and it burped out some ash, and it actually came into Portland. And so you'll see news reports in the local newspapers and early television reports that, oh, you know, Mount St. Helens blew up ash, and we've got a half an inch of ash in Portland in there. I was like, you have no idea. All these people are like, oh, I'm freaking out, you know. Yeah, but when it did actually go, my brother actually knew Dave Johnson, the gentleman that was the geologist that was up there saying.
Now, famously with the Johnson Ridge.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he was good friends with him. And yeah, it was him who said, this is it. So, unfortunately. And
what was it? Vancouver, here it comes?
Yeah, because that's where the U.S. Geological offices were, in Vancouver, Washington.
Right. Now, I remember, or I have read in the past, that the volcano on the 18th, from the big explosion, continuous ash flow for 19 hours is what I read. Does that sound to your memory?
Yeah, I know it was extensive. And I if I had to go back and look, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it was longer than that. It just kept spewing ash. And, I mean, it took months to recover if you were in line. That they had ash all the way to South Dakota, and even at the lighter stuff that was in the atmosphere, it darkened a direct line of wherever the wind was going east. It was in the atmosphere for months and months. But yeah, it was pretty crazy. All the crops in Wenatchee, Yakima, that area, they were just decimated. So it took years to recover from the ash falling onto the ground.
What did it do to your car?
Well, that's interesting too. It, other than ruining my window, I didn't think that it really got into my engine. but I didn't check and didn't clean out, didn't go and do a pressure wash of my engine. But my back seat was absolutely full of ash. It looked like a snowdrift in my back seat. But it did ruin my window, so I ended up having to get that fixed. But less than 45 days later, I'm driving on the freeway and my engine seized up. And then when the guy took the head off the engine and checked the gaskets, and the gaskets were fried, but he said your engine was full of ash. And
yeah, and I would imagine, I mean, would it like turn to cement under heat?
Yeah, it did that too. So it fried everything that was either touched by oil or water, radiator fluid. And so, yeah, it destroyed my engine. That car saw its last days. Unfortunately.
No, I could only imagine, and I'm sure that kind of thing happened to a lot of other cars and vehicles at the time. Nobody was prepared for that, you know.
Yeah.
Not in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember being a kid and playing in it and scraping it off of cars with a playing card to gather this little bit that I have, and it scratches paint and
easy. Yeah, very easy, much yeah. So. It ended up becoming a another industry all on its own. People were gathering it up and melting it down, making clay, pottery, glassware with it, and selling it like the pet rock for a while.
I remember that. And I remember the t-shirts.
Yep.
And especially the Harry Truman shirts. Give 'em hell, Harry.
He was a legend. Spirit Lake, when I was a kid, Spirit Lake was a beautiful place to go and stay and camp. And they had I was in Boy Scouts too. And I remember running up the side of the mountain and playing like crazy up there. It was just absolutely gorgeous, very, very scenic. And Harry Truman lived right there near that lake and also in that Johnson Ridge area. In later part of my life, I bought a cabin on the other side, the south side of the mountain, a place called Merrill Lake. And it was, there wasn't a bit of ash on that side of the mountain, which is crazy. Just nothing. No devastation either on that side of the mountains. It was all on the northeast and east side of the mountain. Strange. And it was, if it wasn't for earthquakes that knocked off that side of the mountain, they would have gone straight up or in a different direction. So we're
sure
it was unfortunate with the loss of life that was there, but it was probably the less loss of life if having gone in that direction.
No, it's true. And I have newspapers that I've gathered from various garage sales and flea markets and whatnot, and I on the anniversary I sometimes bring them out and reread the reports and reread the language from the newspapers in the area at the time, and it's a good reflection to hear it from the people who were seeing it and experiencing it at the moment. The details is fascinating, and that's why I wanted to speak to you directly for this anniversary sure. episode. To hear it directly from somebody who experienced it as closely as you did. I can't imagine that hell ride. I keep seeing it as like something out of a movie. You know, all alone, pitch black, can't even see the road, don't know if you're on the road in territory that, yeah, and if you fall into a ash drift, you may not get out. I mean,
it was
scary.
And it was one of those things where my angel on my shoulder, the better judgment part of me, is saying, yeah, turn around. Your job's not worth it. What are you doing? And then the devil on the other side was going, this is historic. This is fun. You're going to really be telling a story for years. And I was like, oh, okay.
I think I'll listen to you, little devil.
That's fun. But no,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it was definitely an experience I'll never forget, and I appreciate you letting me share it.
Absolutely. So what I was curious of is, did you go to work? Did they need you at work? Did you, I mean, did they
we
open?
Didn't have
was there any reason?
They, yeah. The Expo Center was shut down for probably another 2.5 weeks. I didn't have to be there. That's the other irony. I didn't get any kudos for making it to work or anything. So, yeah
you'd think.
I could have stayed in Washougal that whole time.
How was your fiance's opinion of what you did?
She, well, 40... almost 43 years later, we're still together. I my decision making hasn't gotten any better, but she's been very patient and loving. So, yeah, she's glad I made it alive and back down to spend the rest of my life with her.
Well, as long as you got a, you know, I think that's the lesson of all of this is always carry Ritz crackers and a case of beer.
Yes,
wherever you go in case of emergencies.
I would have that in a. Survival kit any day of the week for sure.
Well, Rob Robertson, I really appreciate you being on the program today and giving us this this epic story of survival and adventure during May 18th, 1980.
Yeah, well, thank you for letting me share it. It's a day that will live in infamy, as they've said in the past. And thanks again for having me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, good day. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Past episodes of Times Like Now can be found wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Trevor Collins. I can be reached, trevor@timeslikenow.com. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. And I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on.